Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
It is 10:09 on 620 WTMJ. It's Point Taken. Kristen and Steve on this Tuesday. Is there a budget or a tax deal, I should say, not a budget deal. Is there a tax deal? Is there something for everyone, Kristen?
I don't know. You know, it was interesting. I was in Whitewater all day yesterday, so I was trying to play catch up last night on what the reactions were across different stakeholders, different lawmakers, different candidates for governor. Seems like there's some people who feel like this was a good compromise, and there's some people who have a lot of criticism for the deal that was announced while we were on air yesterday.
Yeah, $2 billion bipartisan compromise, I'm using those words on purpose, spending package. It includes direct payments to income tax filers. I think it's $300 individual, $600 family or household. New funding for schools, a big jump up for special education funding, which is a common budget problem for school districts. So they've been talking about this forever. There's some things being done on property taxes, eliminating taxes on cash tips and overtime pay. So there's a lot in this thing. And I guess my just overriding look at the reaction, and we'll get to some specific reactions in a second, I would say, and I heard the then vice president, then eventually President Joe Biden say this in a meeting I was at once, that don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Everybody wants their way, right? That's sort of politics, modern politics, my way. I'm the smartest person in the world. Our party's better than your party. You suck. We're geniuses, all that stuff. But this budget surplus has been sitting there for a few years.
Well, it's not always the same money, right? No. Some of, like, the last budget, right, they spent it down, but sure. Then this was like a new, because this money hasn't hit the bank yet,
yeah,
right?
But
this
is definitely a good year for
surplus. Estimated,
yeah,
surplus.
Yeah, because of a lot of reasons, money coming in. And it does change by characteristic how we get to that surplus. But we've done fairly well. And I'll credit both sides in the legislature, even though Republicans lead it, for getting that done. Also credit the governor. It's just curious to me that in this instant reaction, we see reactions from like Francesca Hong and Sarah Rodriguez and David Crowley. I'm not putting their titles on, but you know what their titles are. I'm not disrespecting them. Joel Brennan. Who am I missing? I haven't heard a Kirk Bankstead's quote yet.
No, Kirk Bankstead did. He said it's a no. He called it Evers another corporate Democrat.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything from Missy Hughes.
She said she was in favor of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was I didn't see Rodriguez's either.
I have to put up
the one that made the most noise was Kelda Royce, pretty much coming out and slamming it. Brennan was also saying no because he thought it was a backroom deal.
Yeah, I don't agree with him on that. But Kelda Royce, she highlighted the fact that it was three outgoing men.
I think it was Hesselbein.
Is that Hesselbein? Yes,
Hesselbein. Diane Hesselbein. So the Senate Minority Leader, Diane Hesselbein, said that this is not a done deal. And basically,
I would argue it is, but.
Well, I mean, they still have to vote on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But and it is an interesting point as far as when you're governing as a lame duck, because it is this situation that's probably fairly unique as far as both the governor, the Senate Majority Leader, and the Speaker of the Assembly are all lame ducks right now. And they're the ones who negotiated this deal.
Yeah, but this is also sort of an extension of this last remaining moments of this current makeup of the legislature, right? These are men, Robin Voss and Devin Levenhue specifically, who have not been known for the art of the compromise. Although to their credit, they have gotten budget deals done with Tony Evers, governor, over the last few cycles. We have biennial budgets in Wisconsin, as we know, as you know. I guess for me, take the win. And again, a vote has to happen. I think they have the votes. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't spend all this time on it. I give this governor credit because it's so easy to just play the blame game, to just go after the other side. And maybe if I know Democrats are hoping for the trifecta, you know, if they do get that, maybe they'll prove me wrong. But I just see, as much as I demonized the Republicans in their run, which has been over a decade now, leading the legislature for their overreach and not listening to the other side. I just have a funny feeling, I guess depending on who wins, what Democrat wins, we're just going to get the same thing, only the other side. That's my fear. So when I see things like this, an actual bipartisan compromise deal, my spirit is buoyed by the potential of politics. And you can call me politically naive, and I saw a texter said that, yeah, this is just all nonsense or whatever. It seems like something. And I spent the last 4 years before I was on this show and my in other iterations. Something that people were passionate about is getting our money back and property tax relief. And this does that. There's all kinds of things we could pay for. Some of them noble, some of them a wish list. And I'm not opposed to having those conversations in a bipartisan manner. But when I hear one side or the other saying, this is the roadmap, I just shake my head and say, no. These are the things that real governing is made of when you actually have two sides, Democratic governor, Republican-led legislature, getting, I almost said a bad word.
You caught yourself.
Getting it done. I mean, come on.
I mean, I do think it speaks to there's bigger structural problems. I think there's bigger structural problems in our shared revenue that this could have been an opportunity to fix, because that is an issue that it's not just a Milwaukee-Madison issue. This is something that municipalities and counties across the state are dealing with as far as their budgets being tighter and tighter compared to what the services they have to provide. I think we've talked about it plenty with Celestin Morgan on the bigger structural problem with how we fund schools.
That, well, we both are in agreement that has to be fixed.
Yeah, that this is, and actually our friend of the show, Quentin Claybon, yesterday was saying Wisconsin is one of the only places that pays a percent, like as a percentage instead of just dollar amounts when it comes to special education refunding. And so that there is, and like you can never spend less. So this is potentially setting us up to have to spend more because we can never go back, right? And so there's bigger things as far as long-term planning versus a short-term deal that I think you can have honest conversation about the trade-offs. When we come back, though, I want to talk a little bit about how this, I think, as the left-of-center person on the show, this is making Democrats look. So let's talk about that after this. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen. He's Steve. We are talking about the budget deal. I just did the same thing. The deal, property tax deal that has been months in the making of negotiations. And, you know, there's been, this is kind of inside baseball, but there's been criticism of the Evers administration. That's not new as far as how much they work in a vacuum. And there's been criticism. I mean, we saw this when the budget did come out last year, as far as there was a cohort in the Democrats caucus that was not happy with the budget that was negotiated. And there's something to be said as far as unified messaging. And even if this was negotiated in a smaller group than, you know, getting everyone on board, of having cohesion among the party so that you have a unified message when you come out. And so instead, what it sounds like is that this was, I mean, this is obviously why Matt wasn't here yesterday, right? Matt Smith, yeah, who's usually in person on Mondays, told us in the morning, I have an assignment, I got to go there in person. And we know now that this was where he was reporting on the announcement of this deal. But it doesn't sound like any of the other Democrats knew this deal was coming out. And there was no, memo sent out as far as this is why it's good, get on board, this is how we're talking about it. And instead, it's just a free-for-all for everyone to have their reactions and potentially for candidates to have their moment to say how they would govern differently. And it just kind of makes Democrats look a little unorganized, in my opinion, as far instead of, and this is also the fact that, like, we still don't have any commercials on there. And so it's not putting our best foot forward, or I say our, but Democrats' best foot forward, as far as having alignment on what the priorities are should or when there is a trifecta.
It doesn't happen in a vacuum. This is a race for the nomination. So you're going to have disagreement. And this idea that all, this is why this stuff drives me nuts. The idea that you're going to have all of these, every legislator, everyone running is all going to be involved in a discussion before it gets to the special session is nuts. You're mad because you weren't invited to the party in some cases and calling them backroom deals and, you know, all the other things that they've said in their, you know, assorted press releases. This is something that is always worked up by leadership. Then it gets to a special session or an open session. And then you have your opportunity to speak to the issues. If you're mad, go ahead, be mad. But I would say, and I certainly want to put it out there at 855-616-1620 to the audience. I think most Wisconsinites would say, yeah, we're accepting of this compromise in this deal. And I think it, for a lot of people, maybe it's $600 they need, even though it's a one-time thing. Maybe it won't be, because maybe we'll have a surplus next one, the next one after that. We've had a surplus for pretty many years running now. Maybe that's part of, maybe we're taking too much in taxes if we're running surpluses every year. I hate the thing that where candidates go, I wasn't invited to the party, so I'm just going to hate this. I'm going to be mad at you. That's what it felt like to me. Candidates like Kel DeRoy's, we've interviewed her. I've talked to her. This is my opinion. It suggests you're not ready for prime time because you just blow everything up. This kind of commentary from you, and I was trying to find the quotes. Yeah, here it is. It seems so simplistic and so lazy. She called it an election year bribe. It's like,
well, she's really? Not the only person who said that. You sent me James Richardson's article this morning where he was basically calling a spade what, and from his
he point also
of view,
said the Democrats should take the win.
Oh yeah, no, I know. But as far as I think some people casting this as an opportunity for Voss and Lemieux, even though they're on their way out, to save some seats for potential the assembly to still be in the Republican.
Maybe.
But also he called it out that this takes away a big talking point or big campaign issue for Tom Tiffany.
Yeah, but do you think the Democratic candidates understand that idea? Because it doesn't seem like they do.
Well, I mean, that's what Kel DeRoy said, too. She called it basically a bribe, like an election year bribe tactic.
If you think a bipartisan compromise on tax policy or law is the way as you described it, I'm sorry. You're not ready for prime time. This is, in my opinion, again, Democrats aren't going to agree with me. This is how government should work. It should be both sides figuring something out, whether it's lame duck or not. I'm not going to just disregard someone's opinion because they're not running again.
So which part of the deal do you like and dislike?
I love the tax rebate because I've been calling it for years.
Okay.
People, they deserve to get their money back. I'm pull up the actual bullet points of this here real quick. I'm not opposed to the idea of eliminating taxes on cash tips and overtime pay. Help people out. They're
this
struggling.
Reflective of how it is done federally too?
I think so. I think it sort of
because
matches
there was there's some weird caveats with the federal one as far as it's not all tips. It was, and there's still some like things. Some people were surprised as far as how the taxes worked when they thought it was no tax on tips and overtime.
Yeah, and also Wigerson in his great piece, and James is a great commentator on politics, generally from the right side of the aisle. This doesn't eliminate the 400-year spending increase that Governor Evers sort of built in with his veto. It takes that burden and shifts it from the local property tax and takes it from the surplus. Now, there is a cautionary tale here. This is a projected surplus. So I would think there have to be language built into this special session and the language that they eventually vote on that says, pending this surplus, then we can do these things. And again, a lot of texts are saying we should have done this when we had already had a surplus, and good point. But again, there wasn't a lot of compromise happening.
But here's the thing. So I just thought of this. I hadn't thought of it before. But so we were talking yesterday about when Crowley was on Upfront with Matt Smith over the weekend and him saying the unexpected issues with gas being what it is, as far as it not being budgeted for, and that's what they're going to have to do. If that's just for the Milwaukee County budget, what does that look like as a state budget as far as unforeseen costs due to increased tax prices? And does that eat into what this budget surplus would have been?
I would think that those factors already baked into what they think the surplus is going to be because they're already sort of aware of it. They just had these conversations. It's not like the energy thing happened yesterday. We've been talking about this for months. So, at least a couple months since the war started in Iran. So I think that's probably cooked into the recipe here, but I see it as a positive, and I for Democrats, I know that you have to sort of separate now, and again, you made the point earlier, boy, you can go travel the state if you want and tweet out your little fun little things you do, but man, you got to start spending money. And if you're holding on to your money, what the hell are you holding on to it for? Because nobody's separating. And whether you believe Joseph Pecky that Mandela Barnes has essentially already got this race, basically is what he's saying, because he's someone that's run at the highest level before, U.S. Senate. I don't know. There's interesting candidates here. We've talked to, I think, all of them, except for some of the minor candidates. They're all interesting people. They all have ideas that present challenges to voters and think, oh, I wonder what they would be like as governor. I wonder why this is the target at this moment in this race. And maybe it is about separation. I'm not a Democrat, so I don't even try to understand. I do try to understand.
You do try to understand.
I don't necessarily, I can't figure it out, I guess is the better way. She's Chris and I'm Steve. Quick break. lot of great texts. Most people agree that they actually supportive of the tax rebate, and whether that happens, we'll see. Obviously, the vote has to happen. Good correction. It's not for the total amount of overtime. It's the amount you make. It's just the amount of overtime and not being taxed. A good clarification there. I made this point to Kristen in the break. I mean, I'm not seeing, other than the general, we're going to do it this way once we have power, I'm not seeing any specifics from Democrats and the candidates on their side that say, this is what we would have done with the surplus. I mean, are you seeing that? Or are you hearing that?
I mean, I think at least from Royce and Hong, it seems like more of a structural. Both of them are, even though Royce got the WEAC endorsement, I think both have been more squarely part of their platform is public schools, funding public schools.
Public schools are going to be happy about this. Special needs, unbelievable. Operational money built in, at least for 1 year. These are great wins for public schools. And to deny that is to me means that you're not paying attention. Because that's what I hear. I talk to school board people all the time. I'm doing a story on it, school boards, and how they're dealing with some of their student movement between districts. This is operations and special needs are the two things they mention every damn day.
There is something else. I mean, we have 30 seconds, so I'm not going to open the can of worms as far as, you know, the big part of this is the increased diagnosis of students with special needs, right? And so that is also what has ballooned as far as the resources. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't give children what they need to be successful in school, but it's a very different world now than it was when I was in school as far as what is available and how much money that costs to provide those to the kids who need it.
Yeah, the rules have changed, and it's tough for school districts.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen. He is Steve. And Steve, if I said underbabied to you, what would you think that means?
I didn't know what you were talking about when you first said it. I know where you're going with this, but now because I heard the story. But
so yesterday,
she's dumb to me.
I get a text from Joe. So Joe, Bill, and I still text pretty much daily. And I think I got off the show. There was a text from Joe with a link to a Dr. Oz news clip from yesterday. And he said, why are they just so effing weird, Bill? I can think of a dozen ways to make this point without the creepy term underbabied. So what is underbabied? So this was yesterday. Dr. Oz was in the Oval Office with Senator Katie Britt, and Trump was in there. And this is what he had to say.
What does underbabied mean? That means that you either don't have any children or you have less children than you would normally want to have.
All right. So that, I mean, I guess that kind of makes sense. It is a term that he made up. This is not a...
It's not an official
term. This is not an official term from any kind of data scientist as far as how we talk about the fertility rate. But, you know, we all know that the fertility rate is lower than what it should be. And so it was interesting, though, because this is not the first time he used the term underbabied. He used it last year in a press conference talking about IVF and funding for that. That has been kind of not quite as what we thought it was going to be when Trump called himself the father of IVF. But then he pivoted in this conference to talk about maternal mortality rates, especially in rural areas, which is a problem, is definitely a problem, especially in black mothers more than anyone are suffering from increased maternal mortality. But I don't think that's what the impact of fertility rates is. Like, when you think about every time the pronatalist crowd talks about fertility rates in this country, what do you think people bring up of why people are having less babies?
Abortion? Abortion? What are you asking me?
As far as what the fertility rate is, as far as like the 2.1. So 2.1 fertility rate is the replacement rate. And the only country that's like of the advanced countries that is even close to that is Israel.
So I guess if I understand your question, why are people choosing not to have kids?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what that's like when you talk
about
not
to have kids. People.
I know, but
what's the reason?
Yeah, that's
economic.
Okay.
Because I'm looking at the numbers right in front of me. The times where we, in my era, booming. We are boomers. In 1980, when the economy sucked, below replacement. We weren't having enough kids. You look to the modern era, and I'll go... Starting in 2010, well below record low. People have budget challenges. It gets tougher. Economic.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, for us, it's interesting because, like, I think, like, because Bill's response to Joe sending that was, KB is underbabied. Because at one kid, especially if we only stay at one kid.
One of my daughters would be underbabied.
Yeah. And so, but what's interesting to me, and, like, I feel like this is where, because whenever the response to any of the kind of pronatalist talking points that come out of the current administration come out, I always see the immediate reaction be childcare, maternity and paternity leave, the cost of everything, the cost of schools, the cost of higher education, climate change, all these different things. And the thing that always gets me is that these countries that also do offer these things also are below the replacement rate for fertility. So, like, I don't think any country has actually figured this out. And what does that mean for the longevity of economies, us as a species? I don't really know. But you think if you point to France, you point to the Nordic countries, like all these places that have free childcare, have like up to a year off for maternity and paternity leave, and like are also like South Korea, who is like their replacement rate is like 0.7, has done tons of different things to try to increase people having kids, and people just aren't having kids. And so I don't know what the solution is. And like, I'm going to always fall on the side that some of these things we should do in America because it's the right thing to do. And I certainly think it, we would see some kind of increase because I do think there's a lot of people who do not have as many kids as they would otherwise because of the economy and such. But like, I'm not sure that's the silver bullet either.
I have no evidence. The Justice Department says that when the Dolly suffered a blackout.
What I'm about to say, but lifestyle choice. Maybe modern, younger women and their husbands or partners decided we don't want to have as many kids. And that could be branded throughout our country and all other countries. They want to move more. They want to be able to more independent. Maybe having three kids or even two kids ties them down in a way they don't want to be tied down. We are a very impatient culture, at least this country. I don't know about the rest of the world. We want to be able to do what we want to do, whether we can afford it or not. That's another piece of the puzzle. There's no, I think you're right. There's no gold pill or magic pill to fix this. But I can tell you that looking at the numbers, we will be a country in decline if we don't replace all of us, and probably more importantly me, boomers, with a massive population, with generations that can support and work and make this country thrive. And that's a big problem. So whether people get hung up on his stupid use of the language, under baby or whatever he said, I'm not a big Dr. Oz supporter, so for me it's just another example of stupidity on full display, including while he's saying some of these things, the president is apparently sleeping in the Oval Office again. So, I mean, take that for what it's worth. It's just, I think we have to think about these questions in different ways. So I support your idea of looking at just beyond the easy answer, which is certainly economic. And I think the numbers bear that. The 80s were tough for a lot of people. You know, you talk about high interest rates now for homes, they were 12%.
Yeah.
My dad had a 12% mortgage. That was tough times. Still had four kids, though. So maybe lifestyle choice is part of that, you know? I don't know. It's not an easy one to solve.
It's not an easy one to solve. It's, I don't think, and I think it's interesting as far as no country has actually solved it, but I do think it's a more holistic answer than we, like, just one-time baby bonuses. And so when you talked about the term underbabied, I found this other clip that I want to talk about when we come back as far as what the definition of pro-life means to different people and whether or not being a whole life pro-lifer is a good definition of it. So stay with us. This is Point Taken.
Welcome back to Point. I almost said my old show's name. How about that? Point Taken on this Tuesday. Talking Tuesday.
Talking Tuesday. Well, we have two guests next hour, but talking.
They'll be talking.
Talking first hour. And actually, it will be interesting to see if we have a lot of things to talk about with Kate Duffy, founder of Motherhood for Good, when she comes in at the top of next hour. But some of these topics she probably has feelings on. And so we were just talking about underbabied, which is Dr. Oz's word for the fact that I think, what did he say? 1 in 3 women are underbabied, meaning they either have 0 children or less children than they would like. I don't really know where he got that data from, but I do know that I think there's lots of people who, if they could afford it, would report that they would have more children. I think there's lots of people who are struggling with infertility and would like to be able to afford IVF.
I was going to say that before. That's very expensive. And also, let's not undercount or underplay the significance of the pandemic, which changed lives in a lot of different ways. I can remember seeing interviews with young women saying, we're not bringing a baby into the uncertainty of what's going on right now.
For sure. And I think the other part of this is when we talk about the people who get pregnant and feel like they can't have the baby because of economics. They already have multiple children, because that is usually who has the largest recipients of abortion are people who already have children. And so the feeling that, like, I cannot reasonably take care of this child is one of the reasons that leads to abortion. And I woke up and I saw this video this morning, which I was kind of surprised, because I would say in my algorithm, I don't get a lot of like Christian podcast clips. And this was a woman who was on a podcast, and her name's Bree Stenstrud, who's the director of Women of Welcome, which is a community dedicated to diving into the whole of scripture to understand God's heart for the immigrant and refugee. And she was talking about her definition of pro-life, which I think is what we think of, I think of when you feel really, truly pro-life and not just anti-abortion.
I'm a whole life pro-lifer. I know what the root causes are for abortion. Whatever anchors me in the preborn space anchors me across all these human dignity spaces. When you get engaged in human dignity issues, you start to see what is actually really needed to save a life. What is actually needed to help life flourish? I know as an adoptive mom that if my son's mother had A, B, C, D, E, you know, if she had adequate housing, adequate health care, if she had education, if she had an intact family, if she had rehabilitation for her parents that were coming in and out of the prison system, she would likely be able to parent my son. And I'm like, what do I really need to be focused on as someone who's deeply pro-life to save a life? To keep the unity of a family. And that is so much more than just legislating away the violent practice of abortion. It's a both and, as much of life is.
What do you think of that definition?
I think this is one of the biggest problems we have. And I talk about it in terms of faith. People practice faith in their place of worship and they forget about all that stuff when they leave. So when you're talking about the implications, the ramifications of having a child, it doesn't end at the birth process.
Yeah.
That's the biggest challenge that I put out there. Stop thinking of the in just this basic term. Look, everyone can define, this is one of those topics that people go crazy on, pro-choice, pro-life. I don't really care what your definition is, but at the end of the day, we should be thinking of the rest of our society, our culture, our country, and helping people succeed. Whatever that means, whether that's child care tax credits or making it easier for families to thrive instead of giving all our money to, like, 20 trillionaires, future trillionaires, which is going to be a real thing. And I can tell you right now, I'm going to be pissed about that.
You think you'll be alive when they'll be when they're still alive once we get to 20?
Maybe not 20. There's going to be one or two in the next 5 years. One's going to be Elon Musk, which really pisses me off.
So wait, are you in favor of taxing billionaires in order to support families?
I want people to pay their fair share. I don't care what your status is, whether it's you make 20 grand or 20 billion. Pay your fair share. And there's too many people that don't pay anything. That's the problem. Half the population pays nothing. I don't like it. And I've said this for years. It's sort of off topic.
It isn't, right? Because I think this is when I see this all the time, right? As far as the fact that there's on one side, you have people who are like, if you can't afford children, don't have them. But we also have a fertility rate problem. But the idea that, like, people are also in the same breath, quote unquote pro-life, but don't care at all about the policies that make having a child successful and being not totally strapped and putting them in a terrible situation. Like, they don't care about those policies. They just care about ending abortion altogether. But it's not realistic as far as the realities of what it is to have a child in this day and age. And I do think taxing billionaires could solve some of these problems.
Billionaires, future trillionaires, whatever it is, everybody's got to pay some taxes.
Look,
all right.
Green.
What's that?
So look at us agreeing.
Yeah, there you go. All right, quick break here on Point Taken. All this week, we're bringing back our last year's honorees for our Salute to Service, thanks to Waterstone Bank, Mission 94, and all our great partners, which we will tell you all about during our Heroes Week next week, Monday through Friday, 11:30 on our clock, right after the bottom of the hour news. We'll reveal our 2026 honorees. This is one of our 2025, Matt Jankowski from the Franklin Police Department.
Hi, my name is Mike Jankowski. I nominated my son, Matt, for Salute to Service.
Hello, my name's Officer Matthew Jankowski. I'm with the City of Franklin Police Department.
He got sworn in September of 2022.
Beyond just the fact that you're proud of your son, why did you nominate him?
My wife and I are going through the Citizens Police Academy right now, and just hearing the fantastic job that my son is doing from his sergeants, from other officers that he works with, I felt compelled that he deserved to be recognized for this award.
You were planning to be a nurse before a police officer, right?
Correct, yeah.
And so what inspired the change?
I really just wanted to give back to the community I was born and raised in. Just having that day-to-day contact with citizens, you're able to have that positive contact. And one of the things I'm very big on is community relations. So just being able to have that connection with the community and be someone they can trust.
What surprised you so far since what you thought the job was going to be versus what it has turned out to be?
Probably the different number of calls and the variety of calls that you go on a day-to-day basis. Most recent call, there was family gathering. Unfortunately, on Mother's Day, someone passed away. So at that point, we were there. We were trying to comfort them in that time of need, as well as trying to work our way through that call and just be someone that that family member could count on.
Being in public service for all those years, we go to a variety of different calls. People's best day, people's worst day. You figure out what they need at that time, how to take care of them, how to help them. Matt has heard a lot of the stories from me over the years, and I see that he is a very caring person and truly wants to make a difference out there with people. I hear from people that he has had interactions with that they've been very positive. He's assisted them in a very good manner. And that is positive outlet for not only police officers, but the Franklin Police Department as well.
How does a young guy, how old are you?
I'm 24.
How does a young guy of 24 have the sort of the wherewithal to be able to deal with those situations that, frankly, a guy of 66 wouldn't be comfortable doing?
It's a very tough job at the end of the day. I'm very grateful I'm able to do this job. It really just comes with experience, learning the different roles that you're able to do, provide, and different avenues to help others succeed.
What does Salute to Service mean to you?
Salute to Service means Matt came from a family that always gives back. I was a fire chief for many years. My wife is a social worker. We chose to serve. And seeing my son in this position, serving the community, giving back, is doing just a fantastic job. Sorry, I'm getting choked.
Salute to Service to me just means that you're able to help, giving back, that at the end of the day, people can count on you, you can count on them, and that overall you can just give back to people.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to the 11 o'clock hour of Point Taken. And our friend is back in the seat. I think it's been a minute. But Kate Duffy, founder of Motherhood for Good, back in studio with us.
Good
looking
to be
very
here.
Springy and you're
I'm trying
you're
to bring spring here a little faster. But as we were just talking about, it's not.
It's a little slow.
Yeah,
it's a little slow.
I'll just say it. The weather sucks.
It sucks. Can we say that on the radio?
Absolutely.
We can say sucks on the radio. It does feel like it feels like we don't get spring anymore.
We
just jump right into summer.
I feel like there's always a couple rogue, really warm days that are exciting. And then, yes, it sucks again, but
not to belabor the point, but remember how warm it was in like February, March? We're thinking, oh, we got 60 and 70 degree days and they just disappeared.
Yeah, well, I think we all knew that wasn't going to last. But
I was
nice.
Hopeful, though.
But I wouldn't mind a few more every now and then.
Yes.
Come on.
Eventually it'll be warm, like maybe next month.
All right. So we're going to talk about some other things, but I at least have to, because as the person who talks a lot about motherhood and
children.
Literally
in the name.
Literally in the name. What do you feel about the term? How do you feel about the term underbabied?
Very creepy. I've never heard it before. Is it like a real term?
No.
No.
Oh. Did he say it jokingly?
No.
No.
He said it first. The first time he said it was, I think, like October. He being Dr. Oz, if you're just joining us. It was the first time I think he talked about it was October last year talking about IVF.
Okay.
And then yesterday it was in regards to maternal mortality. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we spent a little time talking about that in the last hour and just wanted your thoughts on the underbabied.
Underbabied is a very weird and creepy way to talk about women not having as many babies these days. And what we just talked about also is I think it's, you know, there's many reasons people are not having as many children, one of which is people cannot afford anything.
That's the one we hit on, but that's not the only one.
Right.
Lifestyle choices is the one I said. People are more active. There's more opportunities to do things. Maybe that's part of it.
Yeah.
Not that marriage defines having babies, but less people getting married. I don't know.
I also think there's some people who should not have children.
Maybe a smart decision.
Which is a totally different topic as far as there's some people who are not suited to be good parents. But
that's point taken after dark, yeah.
All right. We haven't talked about this race at all, largely because it doesn't affect us. This is in Los Angeles. And you have a really good take on this, I think, Kate, but I have to put it out there. So Spencer Pratt, mm-hmm. the reality star, is running for mayor, mm-hmm. and he's running on like a grievance platform because his house burned down in the fires in early 2025, like the first week mm-hmm. of 2025.
Yeah, I think so.
I have to put this out there because when I was working at a sushi restaurant called Pearl Dragon in the Pacific Palisades, when I was from like 18 to 22, he and his friends were regulars at that restaurant. He hit on me many times. He is exactly what he seems like he is, or at least he was back then. This was 20 years ago. But then he blew up and on the hills. And I like that whole friend group I was adjacent to. And they're basically what you would expect them to be.
Right.
And so it's funny for me now to see him running for mayor and getting more traction mm-hmm. than I think most of us feel like he should be. Mm-hmm. He's running as Republican, but again, we know that, you know, it's more municipality governance. But you had an interesting take on this as far as how you're perceiving this race.
Yeah. And so I made a video yesterday because I like had this thought. I am experiencing this race, I think, like how most people experience most electoral politics, in a sense that, you know, I'm not reading any articles specifically about it. I'm not seeking out information or doing research. I'm just getting information about it passively on social media. So I'm not even really searching it out. I'm just like, when something about the race or Spencer comes up, I kind of watch it, which honestly is how more and more people are getting their information about elections these days. And I know what he stands for and who he is, right? Only because of the work that I do. But if I didn't, I would think what he's saying sounds pretty damn reasonable. You know what I mean? And all of the clips I'm seeing are either him sounding almost kind of normal, or other people talking about how they support him or propping him up or saying this is the change we need. And it's just so interesting because I can see how that whole shtick works so well on people. And I think that, like, it's very reminiscent of Trump and how,
especially Trump 2016.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Trump's not like, you don't really see a clip very often anymore and be like, well, that makes sense. But yeah.
So how does he define himself? Like, populist or just reality TV star running for mayor?
He just says, like, I don't really care about the labels. I'm just running, like, I don't know if he calls himself an independent, but he's like, I'm just a regular guy. I didn't want to run. I didn't want to have to run, but my house burned down. The mayor failed us. And I'm just saying what I think. And these are the solutions that I want, which even no matter what somebody thinks, people are so drawn to that narrative because so many people are sick of politics.
Well, and I think there's also because somehow my husband has gotten a lot of the AI videos that keep getting pumped out on behalf, whether it's his campaign pumping them out or not, he keeps showing them to me. And in reality, a lot of the things that he's running on or things that he's trying to talk about is the drug abuse mm-hmm. and the homelessness issues and a lot of the different not so different from what San Francisco has been dealing with as well, as far mm-hmm. as like a lot of the policies that have led to trying to rehabilitate people, but in general, then making affluent areas feel less and less safe. Right. And there is this kind of, I make X amount of money to pay to live in this neighborhood and I can't send my kids to the park or like I step mm-hmm. on needles and all these different things. And so he's kind of really appealing to a certain demographic, I would say, as far as what am I paying all these property taxes for? Or what am I paying to live in this city to then have this be the realities of what the city is dealing with? But in the same time, it's still a very democratic area that I think doesn't get trying to say like, we're just going to like ship out all the homeless people and it's going to be some other city's problem.
Right. But there's Democrats and then there's people like who don't feel like their kids are safe at the park. That can cause you to vote for somebody else, right?
I think, yeah. So I don't know. It's have you heard much about it?
A little bit, just because you sent me the thing, and I'm just pulled up Kelce, and he's got a 33% chance of winning. Karen Bass has a 56% chance. That's not polling. That's Kelce. Betting.
Okay.
I'm trying to find the polling numbers, but hard to find for some reason. We'll take a break. Kate Duffy, Motherhood for Good, joining us for the full half hour.
Woohoo!
Lots to talk about. We'll get to that after this.
Sounds good. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen. He's Steve. We were talking to Kate Duffy from Motherhood for Good. And a lot of what Motherhood for Good does across social media is talk somewhat about national politics, but also about Wisconsin politics, mm-hmm. since you are based here. And Wisconsin had some news yesterday as far as a new bipartisan negotiated deal between Governor Evers and Devin Lemieux and Robin Voss. And
three men who will all not be here next year.
So we talked about that. Why does that bother you? Because someone's still serving. They have a right to legislate. And obviously it's a special session. I get it. But
totally. I mean, it is what it is, I guess. But it's just weird that like they're talking about basically the nest egg of money we have. And they're not going to be here when we have to deal with like this money being spent down and what that causes to the rest of the.
So what was your initial reaction as far as what you understand with the bill so far?
My initial reaction was like skepticism because, you know, Governor Evers has been a great governor. He has a really good approval rating. He's very popular. But sometimes when he puts these things out and it sounds like so positive, I have learned to know that there's usually more to the story. So like I read it and then it immediately start, you know, looking for other reactions and texting people and trying to figure out like what's going on here.
Whose reaction do you trust from the Democratic side on this?
I don't think there's any like one person I trust, to be honest. Like I talk to different people, like both on on the political side that like work right in politics or in adjacent kind of organizations.
Stakeholders, yeah.
Yeah. And I also like look to see what Republicans are saying. They seem a slightly kind of confused too. I mean,
well, Tiffany came out this morning and said that he's against it. Yeah. But I also think it makes sense as far as this takes away some of his leverage as far as what he would be running on.
Yeah, because they're hitting on that property tax thing. Even though it doesn't touch the 400 year veto, they're just trying to, like, people are going to get checks to hopefully offset some of those property tax increases. And, you know, the biggest part for me that I wanted to look into was the special education reimbursement for public schools. He said that that's coming up to 50%. You know, getting that up higher is a good thing. By the way, public or private schools have a 90% special ed reimbursement. That was a big thing that was coming up over and over and over again during the budget process. I went to a budget listening day and heard it over and over and over again.
Which is also interesting that they have such a high reimbursement rate for private schools, because private schools can also decline to take kids with special needs.
Some do. Some do.
Some do, but they can. They're allowed to.
That's why it's higher. It's an incentive for them, whereas public schools have to take them no matter what.
I would be in the camp they should match.
Yes.
All schools, whatever.
You mean that if their private schools are taking public money, they should have to take the public?
We should play by the same rules. Other than the faith part of it, because many of these are, you know, obviously based on faith.
No, but I do think that there's something to be said as far as like voucher schools. And so it's like if you're taking public money, you should have to take the public. You shouldn't get to decide mm-hmm. like whether it's LGBTQ issues, special needs, like all these different things that
but
they can
also,
have their discretion.
Don't forget, even public schools do some of this means testing. Like, for example, when they take students from outside their district, sometimes they means test these kids. So it's not like universal that the choice charter private schools are doing things that the public schools aren't doing. Because I spent a lot of time looking at this lately. There's a lot of things that don't make sense to me. Maybe just play by the same set of rules. Across
maybe
all
just
the,
have one school system?
One guidebook for schools. Let's fund them the same way. Let's pay for it this way. And we could go on and on. I'm talking about how we pay for schools in the first place because it sucks, mm-hmm. my professional opinion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very confusing. And that figure, while it is higher and is a good thing, you know, I spoke to people, also just people in my DMs who, you know, either have experience in this from just having a child who relies on that or whatever. And it's like, it's still not enough, you know? And so it's really hard to like celebrate something that is still just not meeting where it needs to be. And so
it's also not voted on yet. So, I mean, there's,
yes,
there's debates and consideration and actual votes that have to happen before anything. And this is projected surplus. You know, it's not the surplus we had like a few years ago. This is the projected surplus.
And it doesn't, I mean, they've spent the last 4 or 5 years like not spending the surplus. It doesn't have to be spent right now.
Yeah,
right?
But we already see this is the thing that bothers
Steve's,
me.
Steve's in the camp of, and I do think it's like, just riding, because we also have like a $2 billion rainy day
fund.
Yeah,
we have a rainy day fund, $2 billion. That's always there and it grows. So, I mean, it's not like we don't have money for the, you know, emergencies.
I'm also a fan of like, if continuing to just sit on a surplus because you can't agree how to spend it is not the best scenario either. Like, this is money that should be put to use versus kicking the can because people can't actually negotiate and come to a compromise.
My whole thing on this, and the response is different from all the Democratic candidates, and they're all trying to get their name out there, is sometimes take the win. I mean, you can complain about stuff. You can certainly say, I would do it this way. But, you know, I've spent some time this morning trying to find what they would do differently other than systematic changes in how we fund things, which is not going to happen in the special session. I mean, it's something. School districts, I would say, again, anecdotal, they're going to be happy about some of these things that are coming back to them as soon as this thing gets voted on. I think they're going to be happy about more money for special needs. I think they'll be happy for more operational cost money because they're all crying. I talked to a lot of school board members. They're all crying. They don't have enough. And the taxpayers, ultimately, I'm a fan. I don't want it every year. But if people are paying too much, which is how you get a surplus, and they're complaining about the economy, which is a fair complaint, is really killing their budgets, help these people out. And whether $600 is a lot, not a lot to me, it might be a hell of a lot to somebody that needs $600.
Yeah, it's just a short-term solution once again. And I feel like for the past 8 years, we've gotten a lot of that. And that's not a dig on Evers. He's dealing with a really difficult legislature where they disagree on almost everything. So he's doing what he can. But it's just like, we've normalized these tiny little crumbs that we get. And it's
incrementalism?
Like, yeah. And I just don't, I mean, I think the candidates are frustrated because they're now spending down this money in a way that doesn't necessarily align with their policy priorities or what they would spend their money on. And that's like, and while we have a pretty good chance of getting a Dem trifecta. So why would Evers do that?
That's a great question for the governor. But again, he's been elected by pretty good majorities twice, which suggests Democratic voters, most of them, like the way he does business.
Well, and have we seen statements from Sarah Rodriguez or Mandela yet?
I don't think I have not seen from Mandela. I just saw the one from Rodriguez where she said the deal between Governor Evers and the Republican legislatures is a compromise that's far from perfect, and it's a reminder of how much better off Wisconsin would be with Democratic majorities in the state legislature. I support increasing funding for public schools and special education and providing property tax relief for homeowners. I also support doing more.
That's a very nuanced response.
Yeah. It's similar to Crowley's, where it's like a both and.
Where's Barnes at? Out of town? Where is he at?
Let's go to commercial and we'll see if we can find a response.
Sounds good.
Response
Point taken, 620 WTMJ. Superstar Kate Duffy. You like my throw out to Superstar?
Yeah, did you see me perk up?
Yeah, I saw that. I got your instant attention. Whatever you were doing over there, I got your instant attention. So we've got about a minute or so left. When I think about the work that you do and the way that you communicate to people, it is really, for an older white guy, it's like this is the way people get their news now. This is the way they communicate. You do it really well, but does it ever get to a point it's like just exhausting?
Oh, yes. I get into these modes where I'm just like burnt out and everybody is annoying me on both sides. And I'm like, okay, I need to take a beat and walk away.
Do you take a beat occasionally?
Yeah, so, okay. Yes. And usually a couple days off and I'm like, all right, I'm ready to go again.
Because
so.
you're like all in, it seems like, all the time. It's like, damn.
Yeah, I know. I wish it's like I can't turn it off now, but you guys get it.
How much do people reach out to you and ask you things?
All the time. Yeah. I need to like hire somebody to help me with the inbox.
The DMs.
It's bad, yeah.
Yeah.
How much, because your DMs, I think, are a lot fuller than mine, but as far as sometimes the feeling of people who reach out and ask you questions and the feeling of responsibility to answer that, when in reality, they could also just Google it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's a lot.
All right, Kate Duffy. She's good at what she does. That's why she's here.
She is very good at what she does.
Motherhood for Good. You can find her all over all the social media platforms. Always appreciate your visits and your takes. We'll do it again next month. We've got a, what do you got, a hat? God, this show went fast today.
Carmen Petrie, Sojourner Family Feast Center,
yeah,
coming up
is,
next.
Yeah, great cause, something you're very involved with, and you should all be involved with. They do great work.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bride. He is Steve Scafidi. And over the last couple months, you've heard me talk about the fact that I am co-chairing Sojourner Family Peace Center's annual fundraiser, Be the Light 2026, which is only a month away as of yesterday, which is crazy. June 11th at Discovery World. You can still hit tickets. I think we have a little less than 50 tickets left. We can still take donations for the silent auction if you have any items you'd like to donate, or you can always just donate directly to Sojourner Family Peace Center. But we wanted to have Carmen Petrie, executive director, who you were on about a month ago for 414 Day.
Yep.
But she's back in the studio to talk about some of the challenges that the new, you know, I know we mm-hmm. talked about before in the last, during the COVID, mm-hmm. there was a huge spike of domestic violence. A couple weeks ago when Jeremy Janine was on, mm-hmm. we were talking about the fact that in Milwaukee, shootings have gone down, but right. homicides have not. And one of the reasons is, one, because guns are more lethal, right. but also because some of it, because of domestic violence homicides.
Right.
And so as far as the challenges you're seeing that are unique to 2025, 2026, what are we seeing right now when it comes to domestic violence in and around Milwaukee?
It's really good to be here. Thank you for always shining a light on this issue. What I would say the challenge is we still have far too much lethal violence. You know, last year our high-risk team reviewed 1,600 cases, which means these are cases that are almost a homicide. We had 32 homicides, domestic violence. Last year we're at 17 as of today. So we have far too much lethal violence. The rate of murder-suicide has doubled since last year. We've had several murder-suicides that have happened. And so we're concerned about lethal violence. That's happening in people's lives. You know, last year we had 11,100 phone calls from law enforcement. So there's just way too many families living on the verge of a homicide in our community.
So the work that you do, like someone walks in your doors, describe what the experience would be for someone that's in this situation. You're getting those calls. They're coming to your facilities. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
They're either calling hotline or dropping in and coming in person. The first thing is to have a conversation with an advocate about what's happening in your life, because your circumstance might be different than Kristen's. You might want a restraining order, need a restraining order. She might not. She might want to talk to her employer. So we start out with thinking about safety. What's the reality of happening? What's happening in your life? Do you need to relocate? Do you need a shelter? Do you need to move out of town? So we start with a conversation, and it's really centered on what do you feel comfortable with? What do you think you need for you and your kids, mostly? There's a ton of kids. That's the other thing that concerns me. Thousands of kids are being normalized. Violence is being normalized for them in their lives.
And so, because I think, you know, the biggest, for people who are not familiar with, like, if they haven't experienced themselves, mm-hmm. or they haven't had a friend who's experienced it, I think the blanket response a lot of times is, why don't you just leave?
Right.
And I'm, because of the work that I've done with you and friends and people that I've known, you know, it's not that simple. And a lot of it is always the economic reason as far as actually being afford to leave, especially when you have kids.
Right, exactly. So for us, the message is we're not going to tell you to leave. We're going to help you decide what the next right thing is for you. For some people, leaving is exactly the right thing to do because the violence is at a level where they're about to be a victim of homicide, or they're at a level where they need to leave the violence. But, you know, the economy. Maybe you love the person, you want the violence to stop, you don't know what to do, and we help you sort that out. So I think the message is, you're the expert, we're going to support you and provide you with the resources you need to make the next right decision. It's a long-term endeavor. You know, safety isn't a place you arrive and you're there forever.
It's a process, yeah. I mean, you talked about the need, mm-hmm. so many cases, so many phone calls, so many people walking in. You've done this for decades. Are you optimistic? What keeps you hopeful? What keeps you looking in the positive direction?
We served almost 10,000 clients last year. What I know from having lived experience, I was a kid who grew up, I believe that anything is possible. I believe in people. You know, we're here having a conversation about this issue because you chose to shine a light on it. There are many good people who want to do good and want to support others in our community. survivors are isolated and they need the message that they're not alone. I often say they need to hear three things. You're not alone, it's not your fault, and we're here to help.
What are some of the bigger systemic issues you feel like, whether it's policy or funding, that is beyond the control of Sojourner? Obviously, you help clients when they show up and they're at their some of their darkest hours, but some of the things that can actually go towards violence prevention and domestic violence prevention, right. What are some of the things that you see that we should think about as a society?
So for Sojourner, our strategic issues are housing, the lack of housing, which is a severe, you know, it's a barrier in people's lives, the level of lethal violence, and the Family Peace Center evolving that model of co-located services. But we live in an ocean of extreme poverty, child maltreatment, lack of housing, food insecurity, poverty. We can't solve those issues. We know they impact our clients. Lack of resources for mental health and addiction, which some people will use to manage the trauma in their lives. So as a society, I believe we need a society where people have a resource where they live, work, play, and pray. I'd rather you have an opportunity early on in your life, long before we have to call law enforcement or you have to apply for a restraining order. I want those doors open for people.
Absolutely. All right, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll go on the happier part and talk about Be the Light and what an incredible event it's going to be next month. We're talking to Carmen Petrie, Executive Director of Sojourner Family Peace Center, and this is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen, and Steve is here, and we're talking to Carmen Petrie, Executive Director of Sojourner Family Peace Center. And June 11th, Discovery World.
That's going to come
Be
up
Be the
fast.
Light 2026. The 51st anniversary. Last year was the big 50th anniversary. We had a truncated timeline to get ready for this year back in June. I am so proud to be part of it. It has been an eye-opening experience of what it takes to put on an event like this. And I am just happy to be part of it. I cannot say I've done some, but as far as the work that all of you put into doing this every year, it has been humbling to see what it takes to pull off an event of this magnitude.
It is. We have great staff who organize. What I appreciate about you, Kristen, is the way you frame conversations. So thank you for saying yes to us and for focusing on this issue, along with Paul Bartolotta and Kristen Pierce.
Big names you got going.
Big names.
Yes. Yes, we're excited. And it'll be here before you know it.
It'll be here before you know it. So we still have some tickets left. But as far as for someone who's never been to Be the Light before, how would you describe the evening?
It's a celebration. We'll be out of the room by 10 o'clock. That's important. Get in at 5:30. Have some networking and some cocktail hour. A great dinner. And really the heart of the event is focusing on survivors and their resilience and their courage. It's all about them.
All right. So the text part is just light, right?
L-I-G-H-T. Yes, if you text light, you can get information on, we'll text you information on the event itself, either buying a ticket, donating an auction item that we can put in the silent auction, or just donating to the event if you can't come. Mm-hmm. And so we're raising $525,000. Right. We're over halfway there, which is great.
Very nice.
But we still have a ways to go.
All right. So if someone can't go, your organization is tremendous. In other ways, beyond this event, how can they help you?
Time, treasure, or talent. Get on our website, familypeacecenter.org. Go to the donate button if you want to make a donation. Anything helps the work that we do. We serve 10,000 clients a year, and we only do it because we have support. If you want to volunteer, there's a volunteer button. We need all kinds of people helping us, hands on deck. Or if you want to join a committee or be on our board or help us with an event, do a third-party event. Those are ways you can support the work. Because I guarantee you know someone in your life that's been impacted by this issue.
Well, especially when you think of the stat that it's 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men. It's probably underreported, even what we know for those numbers. And I always say this as far as it is not a issue or a scenario that knows class or race or gender. As far as the prevalence for violence in intimate relationships is not something that is isolated to one group of people. And it's something that, like you said, like, I think we all know someone who's been in a bad relationship and has struggled to figure their way, they're find their way out of it or improve the relationship as it is.
I see this as a human rights issue. Human beings have the right to live in safety, and we help make sure that that happens.
I hope I said it last time, but thanks for dedication to this issue, because it certainly deserves the attention. As Kristen said, it's underreported, so it's probably happening more often than we not. And I would encourage people to either attend the event, and you said some tickets remaining, but help the organization. I've been involved in events throughout the years. They're sort of correlated to what you do, and I've always enjoyed that. And I think it's one of the most noble organizations in our community, and certainly one, as the numbers you were throwing out there, is certainly warranted. So help in any way you can. And thank my you. Pal, partner, teammate is
I got my dress.
Yes.
Oh, you got the dress.
I got the dress.
She does.
Dress for success.
Pretty excited about it.
All right.
It looked pretty good.
And you know, our kids deserve a future without violence.
They do.
They do. Absolutely. All right. So text LIGHT to 855-616-1620 to receive more information on Be the Light 2026 for Sojourner Family Peace Center. Carmen Petrie, as always, a delight having you here.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back to finish up today's show after this.
Busy show today. I mean, I've got a guest, a lot of topics.
A lot of topics.
Talking Tuesday, as they like to say.
All right, what do we have tomorrow? Will Flanders
from Will. Yeah, he's going to talk about a lot of things, including teacher safety and retention of teachers, tenure.
Are we going to talk about the fact that Will's taken up the food truck?
Yes. Cause? We'll talk a little bit about that.
Which I think, I don't know what the legal arguments are, but I am a fan of not shutting down the food trucks, because it does not seem like that is the issue that is causing the takeovers and the
look at you the on loitering. The side of Will. I think.
I know. Yeah. Every once in a while, you know.
So, Will Flanders, if you're listening, get ready for that one and more. And you know, Wednesdays are always interesting. There's a lot of news that's happening. We will rip through all of that with you. A couple things just behind the scenes. If you haven't catched our overtime from last week, it's a good one. Including some fun stuff at the end. Ask Us Anything has sort of shifted to the digital world now, or the post-show world. So if you have a question, you can ask us, and then just text the word ASK, A-S-K, right?
A-S-K.
Does that still work?
Well,
855-616-1 before I say that.
If it's not, I'll send you the link directly. If you text ASK, I'll make sure you get the link.
And they don't have to be serious. I mean, we'll certainly answer the serious political ones, but they can be fun, including the zombie question that we got most recently. And then, obviously, our newsletter, we've been talking a lot about it. I hear apparently soon to be sponsored newsletter. Ooh. So very big news there. It comes out every Sunday morning at around 9-ish. And it's a great quick read. It sort of encapsulates everything we do during the week. It's bonus content. We do a Steve and Kristen recommend. We have always generally Wisconsin stories. Something that we may not even, most of the ones I do, I don't even talk about. Sometimes they touch the show. Just fun, sort of catch up on the week, see what's ahead. Maybe we'll tease an interview. We certainly talked about your big event for Sojourner. Yeah. That's in there. Salute the Services mentioned, because next week is Heroes Week. So we are, if somebody asked me an email, like, where are you at with this? So we have selected our five. We've interviewed two already. We have one today, one Thursday, and we're still a work in progress with a Milwaukee police officer. So that will be our fifth. And then next week in the 11:30 to 11:50 time slot, we introduce these incredible individuals from various departments: Racine, Mayville, Milwaukee. I'm missing one. And their stories. And the reason I do this, to answer that direct question from a listener, because I want you to know there's more than just departments and the general subject of crime and public safety. These are real people. And Wauwatosa is the other community. Great story with a young police officer. I met her yesterday. There's great stories there. I want you to learn about the individuals, because this is the reality that I found out yesterday. When I was mayor and I was working with the police department, there was never any openings. Now every department has openings for these positions.
Hmm.
That speaks to something, and we need to fix that. We need to make sure that people that are working with us in public safety are equipped and their staffs are filled with the people who do great work every day. So that's next week, Heroes Week. Great show today.
Great show.
We'll be back tomorrow on Point Taken on 620 WTMJ, the news, and then midday next.